In this material world. Mahabhaga. O greatly opulent and fortunate Shukadev Goswami. Yata. So that. Eva. Indeed. Narakan. All the hellish conditions. Into which the impious are put. Naraha. Human beings. Nana. Varieties of. Ugra. Terrible. Yatanan. Conditions of suffering. Na'iyat. May not undergo. Tat. That. May. To me. Avyakyatum arasi. Please describe. So translation. Oh, greatly fortunate and opulent Shukadev Goswami, now kindly tell me how human beings may be saved from having to enter hellish conditions in which they suffer terrible pains. So purport by His Divine Grace, Śrīla Prabhupāda, Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai. In the 26th chapter of the 5th canto, Shukadeva Goswami has explained that people who commit sinful acts are forced to enter hellish planets and suffer. Now Maharaja Parikshit, being a devotee, is concerned with how this can be stopped. A Vaishnava is para dukkha dukkhi. In other words, he has no personal troubles, but he is very unhappy to see others in trouble. Prahlad Maharaj said, "My Lord, I have no personal problems, for I have learned how to glorify your transcendental qualities and thus enter a trance of ecstasy. I do not have a problem, however, for I do have a problem, however, for I am simply thinking of these rascals and fools who are busy with maya sukha, temporary happiness, without knowledge of devotional service unto you. This is the problem faced by a Vaishnava. Because a Vaishnava fully takes shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he personally has no problems. But because he is compassionate toward the fallen conditioned souls, he is always thinking of plans to save them from their hellish life in this body and the next." Parikshit Maharaj therefore anxiously wanted to know from Shukadeva Goswami how humanity can be saved from gliding down to hell. Shukadeva Goswami had already explained how people enter hellish life, and he could also explain how they could be saved from it. Intelligent men must take advantage of these instructions. Unfortunately, however, the entire world is lacking Krishna consciousness, and therefore people are suffering from the grossest ignorance and do not even believe in a life after this one. To convince them of their next life is very difficult because they have become almost mad in their pursuit of material enjoyment. Nonetheless, it is our duty, the duty of all sane man, to save them. Maharaj Parikshit is the representative of one who can save them. So, Aduneha Mahabhaga Yatoiva Narakan Nadaha Nanugra yatananeyat tanme vyakyatam arasi. So, Omagana timidanda shaganjana shlakaya chakshun meditam yena tasmai shi gurave namaha. So, this is Parikshit Maharaj's response after hearing about all the hells in the fifth canto. And it's interesting to contrast his response to the response of the Brahmacharyas when we first read the fifth canto. I'll contrast it, because I was a Brahmacharya then. So we all read the fifth canto, you know, about all the hellish punishments and everything like that. And some devotees, not me, but some of the devotees, they were saying, "Wow, look at that. Isn't that great? You know, he's getting put in the sugarcane press, or someone's getting thrown off a mountain, having his bones crushed, and then he has to walk up again. Or, you know, someone is madly in love, he gets to embrace the red-hot form of the opposite sex." You know these things. Or he gets to walk on a planet where the surface is like you know, white hot and burning his feet all the time. Or he gets to eat his own guts, you know, something like that. So we were saying, they really deserve it. They should suffer. So, of course, that's immature consciousness. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about how the conditioned soul likes to see others suffer. You know, we like to see, let them suffer. So that, of course, is the whole conception of friends and enemies. And in modern legal terms, it's called retributive justice. There's two things. I've spoken about this a little bit before. There's what's called restorative justice, and there's retributive justice. Two things. And retributive justice means you're just like teaching them a lesson, get even with them, etc., like that. And restorative justice means you're trying to bring them to the right platform, becoming honest people in society. Unfortunately, most of the justice today is retributive justice. You know, we just want to see them suffer. It makes us feel better if they've done something wrong. But a Vaishnava is not on that platform of friends and enemies. Ajata Shatrava Shanta Sadava Sadabhushana, as Lord Kapila Dev states, he doesn't have an enemy that is ever born. His enemy is never born, in other words. In other words, he's compassionate to everyone. The hardest thing, of course, is to be compassionate to people who attack you and consider you to be their enemy. That's really the hard thing. I mean, it's easy to be it's easier to be a little compassionate. You know, you go on the streets of Delhi, for example, or Bombay, or you watch that movie, you know, Slumdog Millionaire, and you feel compassionate, you know, to the people who are getting blinded and, you know, collecting money and they're being exploited. I mean, it's really, of course, in one sense, that's not really compassion. I'll explain why in a second. That's sympathy. You know, there's a difference between sympathy and compassion. With sympathy, it's yourself. You know, you're just thinking, I feel bad for you, and you're taking a superior position. Oh, you poor dear. You know, like if you see a child that hurts himself, it's, oh, poor dear, I feel so bad for you. But actually, it's still yourself. It's not part of dukkha dukkhi at that point. But anyway, it's easy to feel sorry, whether you call it empathy or sympathy or whatever it is, for someone who is not, doesn't have any connection to you. But for someone who is doing something to you or threatening you or something like that, then that's the hard thing. That's really hard. And how do you do that? You know, that was Rupa's question the other day. You know, how can you actually feel empathy or sympathy or compassion or whatever you call it towards someone who, you know, wants to kill you, considers you to be the enemy, trying to defame you, ruining your reputation. I mean, how do you feel like loving towards such a person like that? And that's the real challenge. Well, actually, I can sort of tell you how to do that by telling you the story of Maharaj Ambarish and Durvasa Muni, because I've analyzed this whole pastime. Once upon a time, as many of you know, Maharaj Ambarish was doing a fast, and it was Dwadasi. Dwadasi is the day after Ekadashi. Everybody knows that? Okay. And you're supposed to break the fast at a certain time. Of course, nowadays in ISKCON, you have all this computerized, right? Isn't that true? So sometimes you're told between 8:53 and 8:54 you have to break the fast. So you got to synchronize your watches with, you know, the standard watches and wherever they have the standard time, you know, coming from the radio station or something like that. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Grains! Boom! Like that. And if you don't do it during that minute, you're a great sinner and you're going to hell and everything like that. It's not really like that. I mean, Krishna is a person. Some people don't understand Krishna is a person. They think Krishna is a ritual. If you don't do everything like, you know, cross your T's and dot your I's properly, you know, Krishna's going to send you to hell. I mean, I don't want to join such a movement where it's like that. So, anyway, so he was, Maharaj Ambarish was observing Ekadashi. It became time to the Dwadasi, and he was doing a near jowl also. And it came time to break. And along comes our friend, Durvasa Muni. The word Durvas means basically a bad face, bad temperament, bad dress, temper. Someone has a temper to them. Do you ever see people like, no matter what you say, if you're not really careful, they get angry with you? They just snap like that at you? So what do you think? You think they're jerks, idiots? You give them all these names like that. You should suffer, demon, uncontrolled senses. You give everybody names. It doesn't help them. It doesn't help you. So anyway, so here comes Durvasa Muni. And Durvasa Muni likes to be fed at any time, day or night, and doesn't want you to eat first. He tests you. He actually tests you. When he comes, you better be careful. Like Kunti, when she was young, she was tested by Durvasa Muni. She prepared prasadam for Durvasa Muni, and then he said, I don't want it. And then around 1 o'clock at night, he said, I'm hungry, and I want it fresh. I don't want any of those leftovers from 3 hours ago. And so she prepared it, very sweet young girl. And as a result, she got the blessing that she could call for any of the demigods, to have a nice romantic relationship with, right? That's Mahabharata's story. So Durvasa Muni, he always tests people like that. There's even one story in the Mahabharata how he tested Krishna. I'm not going to tell that story. It's just, I don't like the story. I won't tell you. I'll tell you a little bit. He hitched Krishna to a chariot, made Krishna pull the chariot. I don't like that story. And he was whipping Krishna. There's some story there. So Durvasa Muni, he was testing Maharaj Ambarish. Maharaj Ambarish wanted to break his fast. Durvasa Muni went to take his bath. And Maharaj Ambarish was thinking, how can I break my fast but not offend this Durvasa Muni? And the sages advised him, you take a little water and break your fast. So water is breaking the fast and not breaking the fast simultaneously if you're doing a nirjal. So he did that, and Durvasa Muni, by his mystic powers, because he was testing like that, he understood what had happened. He came back, pulled out, one of his little hairs, and created this demon. And the demon went to attack Maharaj Ambarish, to kill him. And Maharaj Ambarish, he wasn't too worried about demons, because he was protected by the Sudarsan Chakra, the Supreme Personality Godhead. So the Sudarsan Chakra took care of the demon. Then the Sudarsan Chakra started chasing all over the place after Durvasa Muni. Even went up to Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu said, there's nothing I can do about it. Anyway, it was a whole year of intense pain for Durvasa Muni. He definitely had a pain in the you-know-what for 1 year. And, the back pain, whatever. And there's nothing he could do about it. But the whole time, here's the reason I'm telling you the story. The whole time, Maharaj Ambarish was just like, fasting, performing austerities, because he was feeling compassion for Durvasa Muni. Now, let's analyze it. How could he feel compassion for Durvasa Muni? Why didn't he just say, he deserves it? He deserves to be punished. Look at him, Jai, Haribol, Sudarsan Chakra, go get him. Because of the essence of compassion, that he actually put himself in Durvasa Muni's position and thought, what is he experiencing? Why did he do what he did? Curse me. So a little bit of empathy means you understand that Durvasa Muni, you don't judge someone, first of all. You don't think, what a creep he is. What an agitated so-called yogi. Actually, he's an expansion of Lord Shiva, so you don't want to do that. That would be quite dangerous. So what you do is say, why did he act the way he did towards me? You put yourself in his position. This is actually a very interesting thing. It's called role-playing. And that's really what a Vaishnava does when he's, this part of Dukhi. He's actually seeing, if I was in that position, what would I be doing? What would I be thinking? Why would I do something like that? So he actually thought, Durvasa Muni was probably hungry, When people are hungry, they get a little agitated, don't they? You ever see that? Blood sugar goes down. Children, I've seen adults. Children are sweet when they get agitated, it's cute. But I've seen adults, I have some friends, And I don't want to talk to them right before they eat. You know, adult friends, devotees. Or if I want to ask them, if I want to ask them something, some request, I wait. I ask them, you know, on the phone, you know, I'm calling them on the phone. I say, have you taken prasadam yet? And if they say, no, I say, let me call you back in about 45 minutes after you've eaten. I don't want to disturb your prasadam. And then I call them back and I ask them something. I said, anything you want, Maharaj, I'll give you. Right? Isn't that true? I mean, don't, if you're going to ask someone for a donation, don't do it before they eat. It's kind of stupid, you know. But after they eat, you know, they're sitting around, you know, jolly and everything. All right. Take a $500,000. It's all right. No problem. But before, they won't give you 10 cents. So you actually think, you know, you say that, you know, people have all these basic needs, you know. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about this too. He said, if you're going to be steady in devotional service, steady in life, you have to fulfill your basic spiritual and material needs. And, you know, one of those needs is food, another one is air. And that's why people who, let's say, are poverty-stricken and everything, it's very hard for them to take up spiritual life. So Vaishnavas, this is interesting also, you know, Vaishnavas should also be concerned for the material welfare of people. Of course, with the spiritual welfare at the same time. You know, just like we have our nice, like, Food for Life program or food for whatever you call it here in Sydney. What do you call it?
Food for life.
No, but you have something else here.
Caring for life
or something like that. And then most people are just interested in food for wife. But but that's a funny one. Anyway. And they go out and collect, you know, say, you know, please give me food for life, and it's actually food for wife. But anyway, so getting back to the point, it's not mundane to give people prasadam, to feed people. It's not mundane to help people. I mean, even Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would criticize his disciples who would not help the beggars in the different places. You know, the disciples would walk through the streets in Vrindavan or wherever they were. The beggars would be asking for something. And the devotees would just, like, ignore them. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, you know, you think you're just better like that. You're just proud. You're better. So for devotees to do welfare activities, as long as they're connected with Krishna, I'm not saying, like, mundane welfare activities, you know, we give everybody, like, meat or something like that. But as long as it's connected with Krishna, it's actually a very good strategy for spreading Krishna consciousness. In fact, I mean, look at how the Christians, they spread Christianity in India and other places like that. They open up schools, they open up, you know, feeding places like that. And then, you know, at the same time, if you go to a Christian school, like I know, like in Fiji, some of the devotees go to Christian schools and they actually, you know the Lord's Prayer and they do all these things in the morning there. You know, they actually know a lot about Christianity. So, the Christians have understood this. Muslims have understood this. And so we haven't understood it quite yet. We just think, you know, just chant Hare Krishna, you're hungry, Hare Krishna. That'll take care of it. If you're sick, lying in the street, Hare Krishna. Just chant Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Or if you have some pain, you know, even with each other, we go to another devotee, some devotee's in pain. And you tell the devotee, that's Maya, Prabhu. Your devotee's experiencing extreme pain, you know, cancer. He said, chant Hare Krishna and be happy. You're in Maya. Anyway, because we're not really putting ourselves in the other person's position. There's not really that compassion. So Maharaj Ambarish, he was thinking like that. You know, this Durvasa Muni, he, you know, obviously was a little hungry. And, you know, was a little agitated because blood sugar was down or whatever, you know. And also, you know, he has a desire for respect. You know, so Maharaj Ambarish was actually trying to see through Durvasa Muni's eyes, basically, you know, what Durvasa Muni was experiencing. That's actually empathy. Sympathy would be, I feel so sorry for that Durvasa. Put yourself in a superior position. We feel so sorry for that Durvasa Muni. You know, he's not qualified to be a sage, but, you know, I just have to act nicely towards him or else we get cursed. You know, but he's really a jerk. You know, that's sympathy. But empathy means you try to understand from the other person's perspective. And then he understood, yes, this person. And then he because of that, he was praying to Krishna for the benefit of Durvasa Muni. And he was doing austerities for the benefit of Durvasa Muni. And then Durvasa Muni was forgiven by him later on. So anyway, and so Prabhupada said that one of the primary important qualities of a Vaishnava is forgiveness. You know, a Brahmin and a Vaishnava is forgiveness. And that's a hard one, to forgive someone. Because generally, when someone attacks us, or they, you know, they're trying to do something to us, we actually attack them mentally. We give them a bad name. Like Prabhupada said, you give the dog a bad name and hang him. You ever hear that before? He's like, you stupid idiot. And then you can... it's always like that. You always give someone a designation or a bad name. And that's an upadi, which interferes with the compassion of the Vaishnavas. So we don't want to be doing that. And there's many other examples too of how Vaishnavas, I mean, Vedic literature is full of examples of how Vaishnavas were attacked by people and the Vaishnava actually just responded with compassion. I mean, I could just list the examples one after the other. I mean, of course, you have Haridas Thakur, who was beaten in 22 marketplaces and yet he was concerned with the people beating him. You have Lord Nityananda, who was hit by Madai, and then he was compassionate to Jagai and Madai after that. You just go through it. Or you have also Haridas Thakur, and you know, the prostitute approached him. And the prostitute didn't have such good intentions, was it? But he was just thinking of her welfare. He was just thinking of her welfare. He didn't pass judgment on her. You understand? Passing judgment on her. And in this way, seeing the other person like oneself, in other words, seeing the other person as a human being or as a, you know, living entity or as a spirit soul like oneself, and we don't do that. We see other people as designations generally. And when you see the other person with feelings and thoughts and everything like oneself, then one can actually feel some compassion for others. But generally we see people as things. Right? Things. That's upadi. And of course the Vedic statement is sarvopadi vinir muktam tatpra trayana niyamalam rishikena rishikesha sevanam bhakti ruchate. That in order to become Krishna conscious, we have to give up these upadis. We have to see the inherent unity, one in the mode of goodness. This is also a statement of Krishna in the Gita. That understanding the mode of goodness sees the one underlying spiritual quality of all living entities. In the mode of passion, you see different, the understanding in the mode of passion, this is Bhagavad Gita, for those who don't know, you see different living entities as different. And the mode of ignorance, you just like, you know, pig out. You have no vision, you know, you just like, take, you know, whatever you're doing is what you're supposed to do. You understand? You know, one type of work, Krishna says one type of work is the all-in-all. In other words, whatever you're doing at the moment, you're just like absorbed in it and enjoying your senses. You don't really care what other people think or who other people are or whether they're friends or your enemies. You know, it doesn't really matter. You just want to eat, drink, and be merry. That's mode of ignorance. So generally, people are influenced by passion. So we have to be able to understand how passion is influencing our consciousness in terms of this judgmental thing. That's the friends and enemies. It's the same thing in Sandana Marga they were attempting to teach to Prahlad Maharaj. So we have to transcend that, come up to see the underlying spiritual unity, the equality between all beings, and take the position of others, and then you can become compassionate with anyone, even Ravana. I mean, let's take Ravana, for example. He's a hard one to be compassionate with, isn't it? So let's do a little exercise. Why do you think Ravana acted the way he did? Apart from the fact that it was his actual duty to the Lord, you know, because he was Jai and Vijay, you know, one of the two, and he was part of the Lord's. But what do you think he was thinking? What was going on in his mind? What? What do you, why do you think he would he kidnapped Sita Devi?
Passion.
Passion, yeah. All right, so passion, but that's the type of judgment. But what? But he actually wanted. He wanted love, I guess, or something like that. He wanted beauty, right? Because she was more beautiful than Mandodari. Mandodari was actually kind of beautiful, chaste. She was a nice lady.
He wanted to be good.
He wanted to be control of his environment. Yeah. And he wanted, yeah, I mean, he wanted to be God in the sense that all of us want to be God. You also want to be God. Even though you're dressed in a dhoti. You want to be the God of your wife. Anyway, so you want to be Pati Dev, right? And she's Radharani. Anyway, so we all want that, basically, in the material world, because we want to imitate Krishna. We don't know where our happiness, real happiness, comes from. So we actually all want that same thing. So Ravana is just a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more strong at it than we are. Just like Prabhupada told the story of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great caught a thief, and he said to the thief, you know, what do you have to say for yourself before I pass judgment? And the thief said, you know, what's the difference between me and you? You know, you're a big thief. I'm a small thief. Right? You're a big thief. I'm a small thief. And Alexander the Great said, yeah, you're right, you know. I'm stealing a whole bunch. I get away with it. And you're just stealing a little, and you're not getting away with it. So he let the guy go. It's a good argument in defense. Maybe you should use that in court if you happen to be a criminal. You can say that to the judge, you know, you're a big thief. No, it won't work, obviously. But Alexander the Great, he had some more intelligence. But you can actually see that, you know, Ravana basically was trying to do the same thing that we're all trying to do in this world. Right? And, you know, that makes compassion. What you're trying to do by getting married, you know, I'm not accusing you of anything, but anyway, trying to be the king of your house, the king of your castle, you know, have your Shakti, you know. The Ravana was trying to do in a, you know, just a bigger way, that's all. So we can be compassionate like that, you know. But we're thinking that my attempts to enjoy the material world, they're all right, but you know, everybody else's attempts, you know, they're rascals. So we compare him with us. And in that way, we can be compassionate. You know, he had basic human needs. He wanted love, he wanted beauty, he wanted to control his environment. Perhaps he was a little insecure about life, you know. And in this way, you know, Ravana didn't know that his real self-interest, his real happiness was coming from Krishna. He was in ignorance, right? So we feel compassionate for someone like that. You know, he's in ignorance. Just like sometimes a child will do things that, you know, like a child will run across the street, for example. You know, a little baby will run across, a little young, older than that, will run across the street and they may get hurt because they're in ignorance. They don't know. So it's not that we punish the child for that. I mean, we may hit the child and say, don't do it again or something like that. But it's not that you punish the child for doing that. You're concerned for his safety. So it's out of compassion that you deal with the child. In the same way, you know, Lord Ram was so compassionate with Ravana that he said, this is when Vibhishan came, you know, the story in the Ramayana. Vibhishan came and he actually surrendered to Lord Ram. And the monkeys were saying, you know, how can you do this? He's the brother of our enemy. You know, how can you do this? This is, you know, we're going to be in trouble. Of course, Vibhishan was a great devotee. And Hanuman attested to that fact. But Lord Ram said at that point that even if Ravana himself came and surrendered, I would accept him as mine. And also there's the story when he killed Ravana, he said, now our enmity is finished with his death. Yeah. And then and there's the story like even of Indrajit. When Indrajit was killed, all the monkeys, well, most of the monkeys, I can't say all the monkeys, absolute statements are really usually not so good. So most of the monkeys, they wanted to just tear his body apart and just like, you know, just like take out their vengeance on Indrajit. Whereas Lord Ram wanted to send the body back with great respect. He actually covered Indrajit's body with his own cloth He took his own cloth and he says, send it back with great respect, because he didn't consider Indrajit to be his enemy at that point. You know, there was this compassion and love. Of course, we understand it was the Lord's pastime, but by the Lord having these pastimes, he's teaching us this principle of ajatashatru, not considering anyone to be the enemy, being compassionate to other people, understanding them from their perspective, you know. So we should do that when dealing with others. I mean, it's for us. That example is for us. So anyway, so that will help us, that particular technique will help us develop empathy. So is there any questions about these things? Yeah.
Sometimes you see devotees burning an effigy of
Ravana?
Yeah. How does that sort of...
That's interesting. Like on Rambijai, the devotees sometimes like make a big effigy of Ravana and have a big celebration like that. I have several thoughts about that. First of all, Ravana was killed by Ram, not me. You know, and then it's not that we're supposed to kill Ravana, Ram kills him. And, you know, I have some thoughts. I mean, of course, we may do the festival to attract people in our congregation, but personally, I'm not really in favor of doing that. And also, another point is that when you erect an effigy of Ravana, it may cause some, like, inauspiciousness to occur. I've seen it at some temples. They make this effigy of Ravana, and then something happens in the temple really, like, terrible. You know, I remember one temple, 1 year, the temple president cut his toe off with a lawnmower right when he did that, you know, and then someone else died. I mean, anyway, so are we really supposed to be erecting effigies or deities of demons? I mean, I have some doubts about the whole thing. You know, so I have several thoughts about that. And, of course, we're supposed to take delight when we hear about Ravana being killed by Ram. Why are we supposed to take delight? Is because Ravana gets liberated after that point. You know, when Ram kills, it's not exactly like the Taliban killing someone. You know, that person gets liberated. So that's, you know, I wouldn't mind getting killed by Ram. And you have Ravana's uncle. What was his name again? I forget. Marich. All right, Kate, thank you. So Marich was confronted by Ravana, and he said, Ravana said to him, you know, you should go and take the form of the deer and just lure Ramchandra away so I can kidnap Sitadevi. And Marich said, I'm not going to do that. And Ravana said, if you don't do it, I'm going to kill you. And so Prabhupada said, in his mind, he was thinking, it's better to be killed by Ram than Ravana. You know, so he was making this calculation. He knew he was going to die. But he thought, you know, if I have to die, let me be killed by Ram. Because if I'm killed by Ravana, there's no benefit. If I'm killed by Ram, I go back to Godhead, you know. So he went, Haribo. No, he didn't go Haribo. But actually, when he died, he was crying out for Lakshman. So he went back to Godhead. You understand? He imitated Ram's voice. He went, Lakshman, Lakshman, help, help. That's a good way to die, isn't it? So not only was he killed by Ram, but he was chanting the Lord's holy names when he passed away. So double benefit there for him. So, you know, so I do have my doubts about that particular festival, although it's a traditional festival I see people do. But anyway, I'm not going to interfere with anyone doing it. But, you know, I don't think I'm powerful enough to kill Ravana. I wasn't the one who shot the arrow, yeah.
Marriage, it seems there's a tendency as householders to think, you know, everything's nice, we've got a nice house and living in a nice city, Sydney. But basically, if we analyse it, everyone in the whole city is going to hell, according to the Bhagavatam. And it seems like as householders...
Sounds like a Christian to me. Right?
It seems like as householders we're sort of... we're crippled and what we can do because we have to work full-time jobs and there's not so much time which we can preach and save people. Basically, in Sydney that, you know, there's not a lot of preaching going on. Most of the preaching is done by the, like Devamrita Swami, Brahmacharis.
Yeah.
So is it, to really push on the preaching, we really need...
What?
Brahmacharis?
No.
Is that really important?
No, not really. I mean, the householders, yeah, I mean, they do have to engage in economic development until they're retired. Hopefully they retire before they're 85 or 90. Nowadays we hear people keep working and they're, isn't it? Till like 85. They drop dead, yeah. They retire that way. That's also retirement. So, you know, at a certain stage of life, people should stop or, you know, at least minimize the economic development and then get on to pure spiritual life to help others. But even while one is engaged in economic development, there's so many ways you can help economically. Like Prabhupada said, it's not only that you help physically, you can help with your brain, you can help with money. There's so many different ways you can help the Krishna consciousness movement. I mean, just like we have here, we have a nice temple, we're having Krishna Katha here, isn't it? So, you know, Krishna Vijaya is working very hard as a doctor, operating on a lot of people, taking kidneys out and hearts out and things like that, just so we can preach Krishna consciousness here. Every person who donates a kidney is contributing to the preaching movement. I know he doesn't do operations like that. He's just a general practitioner. So there's something practical. You know, you have a house. Like Prabhupada was asked by the devotees who were getting married, what's the duty of a householder? And Prabhupada replied that before you come and eat, before you eat, you just cry out, you know, three times, anyone's hungry, please let them eat. So you can do so much preaching. I mean, the way we bring people to Krishna consciousness is through making friends. Not simply going out and just yelling on a soapbox in the middle of the city. But, yeah, and that's the way the loft preaching does it too. If you examine the essence of the loft preaching, is that people are coming and the brahmacharis or the brahmacharinis, I don't know if they've been brahmacharinis here in the loft, but in the other places, in New Zealand, they have brahmacharinis. And Auckland too. It's mainly brahmacharinis, and it's not just brahmacharis. But in other places that I've seen, it's mainly brahmacharinis. And they're making friends with people. People come, you get to know them, you network with them, you go to their homes, you sit down and eat in an informal setting, and the same thing can be done with the householders, isn't it? You sit down, take prasadam, you know, people invite people to your home, take prasadam, make friends. That's how people become devotees. Not, you know obviously the standard ways are good too. You know, the Harinams on the street and the book distribution and everything like that. That's good as the introductory step. But the follow-up is best done by householders anyway. You know, you make friends with people, invite them to your home. You remain consistent. I mean, and another thing about householders, which is really nice, usually they remain in one place longer than brahmacharis, right? So you can cultivate people long-term. Whereas, you know, with the brahmacharis, I don't know about this group of brahmacharis, but the brahmacharis, you make friends, and then 3 months later, they're gone to India for 3 months. And then, you know, what happened with my friend? Then the person drops away without regular association with devotees. So the householders should definitely, even when they're engaged in the platform of economic development, they should definitely just be bringing people to their homes, like you do. I mean, what's the problem? And then you make so many devotees. I mean, in many of our temples, I was giving the example yesterday of Split, Croatia, where we don't have any brahmacharis, and we're making more devotees there than you're making in Sydney. I mean, we have to actually, people have to line up to become devotees there, practically. Speaking, you know, they have to take numbers from these little machines, you know.
Watch your turn.
You know, you have to take your turn, you know, just like, is it my turn this month? You know, once a month you're allowed to come to the temple because there's not enough room. So, and they're all householders. They're doing the deity worship. They're doing a prasadam cooking. They take turns, you know. Like one Sunday, it's some household, and Fiji is mainly that too, in Suva. You know, different households, it's their turn that Sunday to cook the Sunday feast. Or you're like, you have your Liverpool program here. I mean, that's preaching, isn't it? So it's not just brahmacharya can preach. Everyone can preach according to their ability and status like that. And you're a householder anyway. And householder means you hold a house and you keep holding it. Anyway, until the mortgage is paid. But you want to arrange things basically so you're freed from economic stress by the time you're 55 or 60, isn't it? I mean, you want to arrange that your children are married. Of course, if you get married a little older, then it's different. At least by the time you're 90, you're free from economic stress. But you're not under economic stress, right? I mean, you're supporting so many ISKCON projects at the same time you're supporting your wife, right? I mean, you're supporting the farm, right? So, yeah, I mean, you're a good example. And there's usually excess money with which households can give to sannyasis or give to some project like that. Like we're doing this project in Govardhan. And if I had to approach the brahmacharis, we'd never be able to do it. Because we need big money. You know, just for getting the land, we need $350,000. So are you going to give that, Rupa? You're going to give that. All right, thank you. She's volunteered. Thank you. You solved a problem for me, you know. I'll give you the bank account details today. You can wire the money. Good. Thank you. I feel so much better. So what's the...
I was just going to make the point also, a householder may be better at approaching people to ask donations for that because if a brahmachari shows up, you know, maybe the person, the donor, is going to say, well, I don't want to give to...
Yeah, because there's not credibility.
Yeah, but say they meet Krishna Vijaya or they meet Navarik or they meet someone like that, they're more likely to give to such a
That's person. A fact. And actually, what you're saying is true. Like, even as a sannyasi, if I go with a householder that people are friendly with, then people are going to give, it'll be credibility for me. You understand? No, you don't understand. As a sannyasi who's asking people to contribute to the Krishna conscious movement, if I approach someone, like in Fiji, I was approaching people for our Govardhan project, and, you know, I was taken by householders who they knew, who were they friendly with, like, you know, Rupanuga, who you all know, probably. Yeah, he took me to see different people who were, you know, multimillionaires or, you know, even more than that, and were capable of giving. If I couldn't just walk into their office and say, I'm a sannyasi, you know, worship me, here's my feet. Here's the feet, you know, $100,000 for each foot, you know. I couldn't do that. So I need the householders to help with that. You know, so in order to be able to do that. You can't just like cold call on someone and get that sort of donation to do a project. So anyway, so yeah. That's the point. So the households serve many functions in the preaching mission. And of course, generally, you know, the householders are considered to be the stomach of the Varnashram system. Stomach means they maintain the rest of the society. They provide the money. I mean, if we really want to do Varnashram, we have to get away from the point of brahmacharis providing money. It has to come to the point of the household. I mean, that's Varnashram. The householders maintain the rest of the society. And it's gone to a certain extent. In the past, it's been the brahmacharis collecting the money, right? So that has to change. That paradigm is definitely not Varnashram. You know, brahmacharis can beg for the spiritual master, but it's not that they should have the financial pressure of maintaining the institution. But you're not a brahmachari anymore. Those days are over. Like they say, I wish I was single again, I wish I was single again. You know that song? I wish I was single because then my pockets did jingle. You ever hear that song? Jingle means they have some money in it. Yeah. I wish I was single again. So, I mean, now you're in that order of life. And be a householder. It's important. So, no, anyway, everybody contributes to the preaching mission. I mean, look at Lord Chaitanya's associates. Most of them were householders. I mean, how many brahmacharis? There was Nisringananda brahmachari, there was a few brahmacharis and some sannyasis, but most of them were householders. Look at Ramanujacharya's followers. Actually, he had a bunch of several thousand renounced ladies who helped too. Ramanujacharya, you read the history of Ramanujacharya. And he had mostly householders. There was this Dhanurdas. Anyway, I'm not going to get into the stories. But he had so many householders assist in his preaching mission. And here I am in Sydney, and it's just mainly visiting the householders. I haven't visited any brahmachari in their home yet. Have I? Is there any in Western Sydney? Probably not. But so there's this whole area of Western Sydney, you know, that I'm dependent on the householders to facilitate my interacting and preaching in this area, right? So there's practical, that's a practical cooperative arrangement. The householders assist the sannyasis and the brahmacharis. Right? So it's nice. Isn't it? I mean, that's varnashram, right there. So households are just as valuable as the brahmacharis. How can you have a body without the stomach? And brahmacharis the legs, households the stomach, run across the arms. Sannyasi is the head. So I get to be the head. I get to eat and someone else digests. No, someone else pays for the food. Anyway. So any other questions about these things? Questions?
Some of the demons that get killed by Krishna get merged into his body.
Yeah.
Exactly name.
Well, they merge into Krishna. They merge into the Brahmana effulgence or into his body.
Same thing, Brahmana effulgence.
No, that's a little bit different. It's a little bit different. The yogis, they sometimes try to merge into his body, but it's basically the same thing in terms of the result. Ultimately, aruyakachena param padam tata patantiya yujmat angreha. Ultimately, they come back.
Even if they go into the body.
Yeah.
They become non-existent.
No. Ultimately, the Bhagavatam says they fall out of that existence and come back to the earthly plane or somewhere in the material world. But, it basically is the same thing. Although it's a little bit different neighborhood, but basically the result is the same. So, any other questions? Yes.
Just in addition to that, if they eventually come back, why is it called liberation? Like, why do we say the demons got liberation?
Liberation because they...
But they're just going to come back, so it's not...
Because they're liberated from their karma, liberated from the results of their impious activities. But it's not a permanent. It's vimukta manina. Actually, that means it's liberation in the mind, basically. In other words, it's not real liberation. Because their minds are impure. For them, that's liberation. And from one perspective, it is also liberation because they have no more karma. You understand? They're freed from the effects of karma. But it's not internal liberation. Whereas in Krishna consciousness, we have eternal liberation. Chakva deham punarjanma naiti mam eti sojuna. Going back to home, back to God. So it's a little bit different.
What about Putana? What happened to Putana?
She got more than just like that liberated. She got to be the mother of Krishna.
So
you should try to kill Krishna and then you get to be the mother. Anyway, so what?
So what did she become? She became the mother.
She became like the mother in the rasa, the parental relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world.
Where did she reside?
Vrindavan.
She went back to Vrindavan?
Yeah.
She became like an associate of Mother Yashoda.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's cool, isn't it? That's cool. And in the previous birth, I mean, if you talk about Putana, it's really interesting. In the previous birth, she was the sister of Bali Maharaj. Bali, not Bhamana.
No.
Bali Maharaj. She was the sister of Bali Maharaj. And when she first saw, here's the story, when she first saw our Bhamana, she actually fell in love with him as a mother, in motherly affection. She says, boy, I'd love to have him as a kid. Please, let me have him as a kid. But then when she saw what Vamana did to her brother, she said, I may be his mother, but I want to kill him too. So there was this mixed sort of, you know, attitude towards Vamana Dev. And so as a result, in the next life, guess who she appeared as? Putana. And she got to be the mother and got purified of her animosity. Like that. So many of... All of the demons had some interesting history. Like even our friend Sarpanaka. You know, Sarpanaka. Does everyone know who she appeared as?
Ravana's sister.
Yeah, I know. I know she's Ravana's sister. But did not, in Krishna Leela, who did she appear as?
I heard that she was Putana.
No. She was not Putana. Now, the Bhaktivinoda Thakur specifically mentions who was who in the past. But, so, who was she in Krishna Leela? Does anyone know? What? She was Kubja. Kubja. She had, you know, the lady with the bad back problems? You know, you say Kuba? No, it's Kubja. Kubja, not Kuba. Kuba is a country south of, you know, the United States, where Fidel Castro resides. But anyway, so she was Kubja, and Kubja got a chance to have a loving relationship with Krishna, right? You know the story? She had a back problem. Krishna just went boop. And she looked beautiful, and she started snatching at Krishna's dhoti.
In front of Balaram.
And Krishna just thought, this is not really appropriate. We'll take care of this later, lady. So he went to her home later. So, a lot of the demons, many demons, Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about, and also demons represent some sort of anartha. Each deity represents an anartha. Anartha means unwanted thing. So, any other questions? Comments? We got a lot to do, a lot of people to visit today. Right, Govardhan? Govardhan's our charioteer. Sarathi. Right? How do you say in Hindi?
Sarathi.
Same thing.
Sarathi.
He's a charioteer. He's like, instead of Krishna, I get Govardhan. Which is almost as good. Okay? On that note, all glories to Shri Prabhupada, Ki Jai.